Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Darren Bresnitz. We're the host of Snacky Tunes.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. This is your host, Joshua David Stein. Today's program is all about community and how restaurants work with their community. We recorded it at The Cecil, which is my favorite restaurant in my neighborhood, in the city, and I think in the world. And we talked to Alexander Smalls, its chef, about not only how The Cecil plays into and is woven into the community of Harlem, but a specific program called CCAP, which is Careers Through Culinary Arts Program, which he and the owner of the Cecil, Dick Parsons, play a big part of. In the second half, we have a live recording from an evening at Minton's, the jazz club that's part of the Cecil and was a home of bebop. It features J.C. Hopkins of the J.C. Hopkins Biggish Band and Queen Esther. First to Alex.
I kind of wanted to open with if you could talk a little bit about the role you see the Cecil playing in the community. One of the things I love about the restaurant and the jazz club is how much a part of Harlem it is, has been.
Right.
And I think that was something that you thought about very consciously.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
My business partner and very good friend, Richard Parsons, Laura Parsons, who've been active in the Harlem community for a number of years. Dick is the chairman of the Apollo, and he also is chairman of the Jazz Foundation. He was one of the founders of the UMES group. So he has been actively engaged in Harlem for many, many years. I moved to Harlem 16 years ago, 1998, and
did you want to start a restaurant up here at the time, or did you think it was ready for it, or were you ready to do that?
Well, I've there were many times in my life that I thought I wanted something in Harlem, a restaurant or something, but I moved here really in transition. I closed my first two restaurants, and I was looking to reinvent myself. I have had a relationship, a friendship with Dick Parsons for many, many years, and we decided that we wanted to do something together, and we wanted that project to be in Harlem. So we looked at this community for many years, looking for the right project, looking for the right location, something that we both felt strongly about. When Minton's and the Cecil space opened up in the Cecil Hotel, we were right on it. I mean, an opportunity to be caretakers for a legacy like Minton's is an extraordinary opportunity.
So for our listeners, Minton's is the home and the birthplace pretty much of bebop.
Yes.
We're actually sitting in the birthplace of bebop right now.
We're sitting here with Monk and Charlie Christian and Dizzy Gillespie and all of these fantastic musicians that played here and stayed upstairs in the Cecil Hotel. So to have that opportunity to kind of preserve the glory and the meaning and purpose of this landmark was exciting. And secondly, I wanted to do something in Harlem. I wanted to be a part of this community, not just someone who lived here, but in the fabric of its rebirth. And the Cecil in Harlem created that opportunity. Minton's created that opportunity. We jumped on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as what you do from a culinary perspective, I think that's also, and we'll get into CCAP, but from a culinary perspective, the food is what you call diaspora cuisine.
Yes.
For me, that that is not only is it delicious, but it opened up my mind a lot to how we think of of it's not just African American cuisine, or it's not just, you know, West African cuisine, or it's everywhere where Africans went and built a culinary culture or wed it to their own or created another one.
I thought it was important to have a culinary conversation about the food of the African diaspora. It's a conversation that was rarely spoken about, taught. So many people didn't understand Africa's contributions. One of the worst horrific moments in our civilization was slavery. I mean, there's no debating that. And you know, it's sometimes hard-pressed to see beautiful things that come out of pain and suffering. But this culinary legacy is all of that. Mm-hmm. We are truly, we have this opportunity to talk about how Africa, through slavery, through migrating people all over the world, changed the culinary landscape of all of the countries that they were shipped to.
And right, as habitated. Opposed to, I feel like what happens a lot, because we're in America, maybe, is kind of black food gets ghettoized as like comfort food or southern
comfort
food.
Comfort food or soul food.
Or soul food, exactly, you know, soul food.
Absolutely, and I think that while some of those terms are endearing, they're diminutive. They really don't speak to the full conversation of what the diaspora culinary is all about. Not to mention, unfortunately, you see a chef of color or a restaurant of color, you immediately assume that it is comfort food, soul food, something other than the creative, artistic expression that is the food. For example, had I opened a French restaurant, somebody would have been trying to say that it's French with soul.
Right. A French with a twist of soul.
Exactly. Only because I happen to be African American.
Right.
That's not a reason.
Did you fight against that when the Cecil opened initially, or did you feel that it was pretty... I mean, the diaspora idea is a step kind of more beyond... It's a step beyond... It's not an easy thing for people to grasp. I think it is really easy for people to say, oh, well, they've got a mac and cheese casserole. They got this. They're
exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, I mean, we live in a society where people are constantly trying to put you in the nearest box they can, so they can essentially be comfortable with who and what you are. I mean, and also using a term like diaspora, it's a huge word. I mean, a lot of people are just vaguely familiar with it. But what we're doing really comes with scholarship. It's a real live historical event that's undisputed. And so what I've done is I've given people an opportunity to learn more about the food of the African diaspora and the diaspora through a culinary experience, you know. And I think people were really receptive to it. I've been in the culinary business for a number of years. My first restaurant I opened almost 20 years ago, and it was my having to fight against everyone wanting to call it a soul food restaurant.
Cafe
Bula.
Yeah, Bula.
And everything that came with that. And I wanted to say, no, this is a restaurant that is expressing itself in Southern Revival cooking based on low country cooking from Charleston, Buford, South Carolina. That was the conversation I wanted to have with people. And I fought to have that conversation.
As opposed to just, oh,
it's soul food.
And then it deserve to have more of a conversation had about it.
Exactly. So I was more than prepared when I did the Cecil, because I understood what was involved when you introduced people to something that you wanted them to buy into.
Well, I think that's also a great transition into what CCAP does. So
yes.
CCAP brings in at-risk youth.
Yes.
It goes into the high schools,
right.
Gives them culinary training, and sort of exposes them to the world of making hospitality, I guess, a profession. And you're quite involved with it.
I'm having a great time being involved with the Grossmans and Susan Robbins. It's an incredible organization. It really, I mean, I imagine what it must have been like for Richard Grossman to decide that his culinary contribution should be expressed in that way, in learning and teaching and exposing young people, giving them opportunity to be creative and expressive in a culinary field, but also tools for life.
Right.
And that's what CCAP does. It gives young people who may not have a sense of themselves, may not have a sense of what they could possibly do or be, not even entertaining college. CCAP comes in and says, you like to cook? Here's a recipe. Let me show you how to make that. This is the same kind of recipe that Jean-Georges is making. And they take these kids on an extraordinary journey of realization, because they begin to realize what they can do.
Tell me about, I know you have a couple of people in the kitchen who went through the program.
Oh, yeah. We've had some great kids from CCAP.
Tell me a favorite story of yours from the...
Well, you know, I would say one of the biggest moments that sticks out for me is when we were catering an event with the Africa Center on 110th and Fifth Avenue. There were about four of them, and all of the ages of, I would say, between 16 and 17. And I had some manning the grill. They were dressed to perfection. They looked fantastic. And they not only did they represent us well, they enjoyed the experience of feeding all those people. We must have fed 500 people that day. And they were right there in it with us. You know, so when I think of CCAP, I think of this is my seeding ground for extraordinary talent coming in.
And it also seems that with a cuisine like yours,
yes,
and with a restaurant like yours, there's even more of a connection, because it's not just an at-risk youth goes to a kitchen and cooks a fancy French dish.
No.
It's that they're connecting this culinary tradition in a kind of fine dining sense.
Right.
But to their own lives.
Exactly, from where they come.
Right.
I mean, you know, they can see themselves. So it's not a foreign or disconnect. They see themselves in the culinary. They see themselves in the story. They're able to have a unique ownership about what they're doing. And again, they're not only getting a skill, they're building character, their awareness of themselves. I mean, in many ways, CCAP does exactly what the Parsons and I wanted to do in Harlem. We have a strong initiative of hiring from the community. We have a strong initiative of being available to the community and encouraging community presence. Restaurants have a bigger responsibility in communities like this, and I think all over America, but certainly in a community like Harlem, we have to be more than some place where people come to eat.
Right.
They come to realize themselves, realize their neighbors. You know, if you're in these restaurants, be it the Cecil or Minton's, you are getting to know your neighbors. I love how my customers talk back and forth to each other. Sometimes I see them sharing food.
Right.
You know, there is a quiet, festive, communal feeling about what we do here.
Do you think are most of your customers from the community, or are they from other places like downtown?
They're from all over the city. I mean, you know, Harlem is still a market that we depend heavily on destination traffic.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've noticed is the extraordinary change in the community. It is a multicultural, racial, international community.
Right.
And more each day. I mean, you live here.
Even me.
You know, the whole idea of having a restaurant where everyone feels a sense of belonging and ownership.
I think something for me, just as a consumer, or, you know, coming in, that you can tell, especially up here, you can tell when restaurants are something genuine for the community, and sort of like an inclusive idea of community,
right,
but for the community, and you want to be a part of it. Like, I want to be a part of whatever's happening at the Cecil or Minton's, because
it
resonates.
Right.
You know, you just want to be somewhere where it feels like there's the animating spirit is one of, it's a good spirit of inclusivity. That's
what I feel. I think that's what restaurants have a responsibility to be now. You know, restaurants used to be a bit standoffish. They could be, you know, very disconnected. You know, you could go to a restaurant and be very uncomfortable. And your check reflected part of that. you know, there's an extra 30% for attitude. You know, but now there is, first of all, we eat differently now. I mean, people really don't want pompous food. They don't want food that look like sculpture pieces. They don't want to be intimidated by ambiance, by food, by servers. They want to be received, mm-hmm. accepted, entertained, and treated well.
But see, I think an interesting point that you hit on here is you want to be entertained and treated well and comforted, but that doesn't mean you can still have really well-executed food.
Absolutely.
You can have really well-executed service.
Absolutely.
You can be comfortable but not sort of pandering to,
right.
You know,
popular taste.
Comfort. Yeah, popular taste, but comfort, like, you know, just fried and,
right.
you know, because
right.
there's a lot of places, and it's kind of easy to do that.
Sure.
Sort of thing.
Well, there's an expectation. I mean, that is not to say that I haven't had a couple of clients who came in and expected and wanted soul food and was upset when they considered or decided that, in fact, the food that we were serving didn't quite make soul food category for them. I've had some to leave. Interestingly enough. So there are those various experiences,
Fools.
You know, but everybody, for the most part, stays and enjoys this experience,
yeah.
you know. And what is happening is people are more adventurous than ever now regarding food. It used to be salt and pepper ruled, you know. It used to be you couldn't use strong aromatic spices and flavors. People would be offended by them. You know, the idea was to take it as close to the edge of flavor without jumping overboard.
Right.
And so you'd give people moderately tasting food, and then you put hot sauce on the table, or you put salt and pepper.
Right.
We don't put anything on the table. You'd have to ask us for those things.
Because it's all on the plate.
Because it's on the plate. The experience is in the food.
We'll be back after a short break with J.C. Hopkins. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's going to sing a song or two.
So, JC, hi.
Josh. Hi.
How are you?
Good, good.
So, just talking to Alexander about bringing members of the community on state, into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who's playing at Minton's and in the jazz world and in the music world, I kind of wanted to ask you about how sort of education works in that way, giving people opportunities works in that way. You know, as part of a biggish band,
right.
you have a lineup of musicians. How does, you know, how does one break into it? How are you bringing in new talent? How are you out?
Well, you know, it's like people have their seat for a reason because, in my opinion, they're the best possible person to be there, to be playing baritone saxophone or alto sax or trumpets. But, you know, it is New York City. People do get, there are other engagements. So it is fluid, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's say a tenor saxophone seat is one of the more fluid seats. You know, cats.
Why is that?
Okay, I don't know. Because I use very fine players and they're in demand, so
yeah.
one cat can't make it, then you get the other one who can, and you know, that's kind of true with, like, basically there's rotisserie, you know, like
yeah.
a trumpet, you know, we have a number of cats, like Wayne Tucker, who's our musical director and our trumpet player. He's 27 years old, you know, he's you know, young up and coming, but he's out playing with Taylor Swift or, you know what.
It, right.
And he out, you know, they
Taylor pass, Swift Trump's mittens in this case.
You know, I kind of feel like it's selling out, but it's like, you know, you gotta sell out, you gotta sell.
So one of the things about playing in an ensemble is, and also playing the type of music where part of it is a riff, well, part of it is written and part of it you're improvising, right?
Yeah, what happens is that there's a headshot, basically, I'll call a tune that's like more of a standard, like Night in Tunisia, but everybody knows their parts and we could just play it and nobody has to look at anything. Say we do On the Sunny Side of the Street, I mean, that could be done 5 million different ways,
right?
But you know, if somebody starts playing the Dizzy Gillespie version, you know, everybody's just going to go in that direction.
You have to know the tune and you have to know all the major variations.
References, yeah.
Okay, well, I hope you play Sunny Side of the Street.
Okay, well, hopefully Queen will be here and then we can do that.
Thank you.
That does it for our show. I'd like to thank Alexander Smalls, J.C. Hopkins, and the J.C. Hopkins Biggish Band. I'll see you again next week on the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.